I am impressed that so many of you have come so far, so often, and worked so hard. And I'm sure that we want to bring our labors to full fruition. So I suggest that we work on into the wee hours of the night, if necessary, to produce this document that will determine the future of Alaska. It's with real regret that I come to this last plenary session where we have a presentation of this kind. I'd really rather stay up here for Christmas and would welcome an invitation from someone to visit with them. So I'm prepared to work on the rest of the week myself. I love it, so I'm ready to stay here. But we can take advantage of the fact that we do have a long afternoon, and we do have this evening, and we have a bevy of young ladies waiting to rush frantically to producing the reports so that we'll have them ready for tomorrow morning. I am thinking, unless we get a considerable amount of flack from this, that instead of starting at 8 o'clock, which seems a horrible hour, that we might start at 8:30. We were starting at 8 o'clock because we had colleagues who were catching a plane back to the southeast, but that plane has changed its schedule and they can't wait until the program is completed anyhow, so we might as well set the time at 8:30, and then we'd be through with our ceremonies by 10:30, during which we will read the reports. We will, in association with the University of Alaska, we will present certificates to you who have achieved them, and then we will have a wind-up with Senator Jay Hammond reading a poem. And so it will be a very good morning that we will have together, a very leisurely morning. Unless I get a lot of flack out of that, we'll let it go. Now, it is a fortunate state indeed who has a son or an adopted son who believes in it with such fervor and who studies it with such devotion, and then who writes about it with such excellence. And it's with real pride, sense of privilege, that we turn to you, George, and give you the honor here of bringing everything to a focus by talking about what you see to be the issues that face future Alaska and the policies that we ought to be thinking about with which to meet those issues.
I'm going to continue where I left off yesterday, if I may. I hope I can get some focus into this that may be helpful to you. The assigned topics, as you know, yesterday I was supposed to talk about directions and today strategies. Again, we need some definitions, and I think the best way to define strategy at this point is to refer to Paul Ilversacker's example of yesterday of the man in the room with all the rabbits trying to pick them up, took them under his arm. Since I spoke to you last, I've sat in on two of the sections briefly and read the comprehensive consolidated report of seminars 1, 2, and 3. And I feel that you're in the position of that man with the rabbits at this point. You have not only the problem of picking up the rabbits, trying to collect them and herd them, but enough time has elapsed that the rabbits taking their natural course have begun to multiply. And so also I find that the room has guinea pigs and squirrels as well as rabbits in it. But to get back to Paul's example, what you are faced with now is picking out of this mass of rabbits and whatever, what he called the lead rabbits, assuming that there are such creatures in rabbit society. And this, of course, is selecting the strategic items in the agenda that you have been putting together here. And this, of course, is the final job. You've had the opportunity, or rather the task of trying to dredge up out of your experience and your backgrounds the necessary focus and so on to put together some ideas of what we want to do with Alaska. Now the job becomes one of organizing these ideas. And then eventually, which seems to be a reversal of the logical process, come up with the strategic policy issues that you are facing. Yesterday I said I was talking about the preconditions for determining policy issues and making choices. And I did this in a rather rambling way. I'm going to elaborate a little bit on that and then go on. The preconditioning stage is part of a strategy. This is the point at which the choice and implementation of economic or social development policies require the putting together of a very profound body of knowledge of our present situation and of the spontaneous developments that are foreseeable over different time horizons. Spontaneous may not be the correct word, but what I have in mind, I think you understand, are the developments that are going to be taking place in spite of what we might do. As Alaskans, we call them outside directed developments, or things that will arise as a natural result of the process that is going on. A precondition of formulating a policy strategy also requires a knowledge or understanding of what Paul Ilversacker talked about this morning when he talked about the bargaining or trade-off world in which we operate. In generalized, idealized terms, this is the continuing bargain that must go on between those who have the responsibility of somehow determining, identifying, and protecting the public interest, and those who represent special or private interests. Now, although I've separated the two here, they are part of one another. The public interest is made up of a lot of private interests and the compromises and so on that take place in the negotiating process to arrive at some sort of basis for living together and operating together. Now, the first set of data or knowledge includes a sharpening of our awareness of our development potentials, our resources, our locations, and so on. I'm saying some very obvious things now. Markets for various things we might produce. And the markets, of course, include not only goods, but services, including defense. And technological trends. It also should include a constant re-evaluation of our goals and long-range objectives and their translation into specific terms related to the immediate situation in which we live or the one in which we anticipate living. To cite an example, if an economic development is to take place in part of Alaska, where we have an underutilized labor force, public policy for social development, as contrasted with economic development, should focus on increasing more intensive labor utilization in the process of the economic development. And the choice of policies might range over alternatives, which would include a legislation requiring local hire or preference for local hire, the fostering of labor-intensive technology through subsidy or regulation, the training of a suitable, skilled local labor force. All of these policies or versions of them are familiar to you because we are toying, playing, and trying to implement them in the present situation of the North Slope oil developments and the TAPS construction project. We are trying, because these developments are taking place in parts of the state where we have a resident underutilized labor force, we're trying to get that labor force geared up and into the employment stream, into the job opportunities, the job openings that are being created. In this, we are soliciting and in large part getting considerable cooperation from the industry. But it required, you see, a formulation, a statement of policy by either political groups such as the Alaska Federation of Natives, the Alaska Legislature, the Governor's Office, and all the various levels of government in the state, and the expression of popular sentiment through our press to bring this to the attention of the industry and to get them into the position of accepting some measure of responsibility for seeing that this social development might be promoted. What I said so far is that a strategy for policy formulation requires increasing data and analysis upon which to base our judgment. It requires, in addition, the recruiting and training of adequate staff, and by that I don't mean just merely research people, but people in the executive positions. Paul Oversacker spoke at length about this, and I won't repeat what he said, merely remind you of what he was saying, the various approaches we might use in doing this through intern training, through our educational system, and so on. It also requires upgrading of official and popular understanding of basic development issues, the limitations as well as the potentials for influencing development along desired lines, and so on. I think this body is a good example of an attempt to do this, to upgrade both official understanding and popular understanding of the issues before us. Finally, there's a need in formulating a strategy to relate the technician, the technical data, to the entire political process, because it's within the political process that policy formulation takes place. This group may come up with a list of policies, but these are merely recommendations. They have to be introduced into the legislative and into the political process before they become true policies and can be implemented. I would like to cite one example that I find very encouraging, not just because I'm involved in it, and that's the department, our own Department of Labor, has recently undertaken, with funds both from the Department of Labor and Department of Education, a very comprehensive study of Alaska's manpower situation. This is being carried out simultaneously on three levels. We have set up and we have a team of young men whom we are training, who have had some training, and we are trying to adapt them to this particular situation, who are conducting surveys of, first of all, Alaska's manpower skills, an inventory of what is available. In this, we are cooperating with the Alaska Federation of Natives and the various rural development agencies in the state who have earlier set into motion projects for setting up what they call manpower banks. We're also conducting with another group a very intensive survey of the industrial makeup of our economy at the present time and the projections of this economy into the immediate future. And out of this, we're getting a great deal of information for the first time on the sort of occupational mix that goes into these developments. In the past, we've used only very crude approximations of total employment. And this is not very useful. It's useful, but it's not useful enough to formulate and pinpoint policy matters. Out of this, we'll have some idea of what the demand for various occupations is and will be in the immediate future, and how Alaska stands in terms of supplying and meeting those demands. And this is where the third level comes in. We're also making a survey and evaluation of all existing training educational programs in the state, whether they be in private schools, in technical schools, and so on. We're trying to determine from this the effectiveness of our existing educational, vocational training setup to provide the means for bridging the gap between supply and demand using Alaska's human resources. I say, to my knowledge, this is the first time there's been such a three-pronged approach to the situation. In different ways, we will have to do something similar to this in almost every area we're concerned with in Alaska's development if we are to have what I referred to at the beginning as the profound, not superficial, but profound knowledge, which is a necessary precondition for laying out and making an effective policy strategy. Now, obviously, we can't do all of this, and we have to make do with what data we have, but we should constantly be working toward the ideal. As I said, it's a matter of increasing our ability to gather, analyze and interpret data. We have the means at hand to do that now. We have the hardware, which we're underutilizing. We need to develop the trained staff to then use the hardware we've invested in to more effectively meet these demands. We need to train a higher level of competence in our public agencies. This is no reflection on the people who are already there. It's just that they need further help and they need further training themselves. And then I say we need to upgrade public awareness, public participation, and understanding of the whole process. A second set of data I talked about, I've talked about the knowledge of our situation, the knowledge of the potentials and limitations and so on. I want to get back just briefly to the second set of data or knowledge, which was relates to the bargaining process. And this includes a continuous reconsideration and redefinition of what we mean by the public interest, what we consider to be our objectives, our long-range and short-range objectives, what we want Alaska to be, in short. Somehow to translate that into specifics that are relevant to the particular issue we are dealing with. Again, this requires information and skill, understanding, and it requires participation not only of technical experts, but of everybody involved in the political process. We also have to have some understanding of the objectives, the motivations, and the strategies employed by those who represent private or special interests within this mix. As I said earlier, I'm not excluding the private interest from the public interest, but when it is taken in isolation, its objectives may be contrary to what we conceive to be the public interest. This is particularly important, as I said yesterday, in that we are moving toward developments which will bring in some very powerful economic interests in the form of the petroleum industry, and some very, very, very powerful international groups in the form of Japanese industrialists and developers and investors. And it behooves us to know as much as we can about these people so that we can represent Alaska's interests most effectively. Policy strategy also should include, and does include, an attempt to inject these social and economic development objectives and considerations into our going activities. Public policy decisions made by existing agencies, in other words, the existing structure we have set up to carry out various programs. These structures and agencies do not in themselves generate self-sustaining growth or development within the state. They have to be directed this way. They have to be directed by legislative action, by legislative programs, by popular pressures, and so on. In other words, they have to be directed by the proper use of the political process. Otherwise, they simply sink back into a bureaucracy which goes on perpetuating itself and precious little else. Paul Urwasacker, I think, touched on this very effectively this morning when he said, for goodness sakes, when you're considering development of human resources, don't just say, well, we'll just put more money into good things like education. Before you sit down with the people who are in charge of education and bargain and negotiate with them as to what will come out of this investment. I think Paul's point here is one that we should take to heart. We do have programs that are designed to carry out and promote various objectives, but let us remind ourselves that these are not self-generating, self-moving programs. They are merely self-perpetuating unless they constantly have an injection from outside, from us. In addition to influencing the ongoing programs and activities, we must have another level of strategy. This element of strategy affects or should affect the achievement of development goals or move us along that way. But we've also got to consider new programs, because as the process goes on, new needs emerge. And we've got to identify these and then consider if the existing programs cannot handle them, how we can bring into being new programs. This group has considered a great deal of this. You have spent a great deal of time on the need for programs and so on relating to protection of the environment. This is new in Alaska. The need for it, of course, always existed, but it was considered to be a fairly minor thing 10 years ago. But it is obvious to us now that it is not a minor thing any longer. And it's something, it's a need that has to be met. And this group has directed a great deal of its attention and put a great deal of the weight of its recommendations behind the suggestion that programs be established to meet this new emerging need. Another need which I haven't found reflected in this group, and I'm not scolding you, I mean, this is something I got from members of the group as well as from my own reading, is that there is an urgent need for technical studies and explicit policy formation on urbanization. And later on in my remarks, I want to come back to this particular area. This again is something, a need for this existed, it has existed since Alaska almost came into being. But the need now has risen to critical emergency levels. And so we should be considering programs and policies that might meet these needs. Another need, which I think has been recognized, maybe not clearly enough yet, and I am one of the people who hasn't been able yet to formulate my views on this, are the needs in connection with the native transition and the aftermath of the settlement or disposal of the land claim settlement. And finally, another need which I think the group recognizes is a need for policy guidelines for the use of $900 million, what I referred to yesterday as the need for learning how to be rich and happy. Finally, strategy should include the observation, analysis, and evaluation of what comes out of policies that are chosen and implemented. I think we can go on endlessly tying ourselves up in knots, not taking any action because we feel we should make one more study before we take this jump. An alternative to this is to use the best data we have on hand, and remember, I'm suggesting that we should improve this, but not necessarily wait for this, use the best data we have on hand and try something. But when we try it, let's look upon this as yet another experiment, and let's treat it as that, and let us objectively evaluate the results and performance, the experience of this experiment, and let us learn from that and go on. Instead of making endless studies, we will then start making experiments or doing things and calling them experiments. We're doing them now, and they are experiments. But unless we follow up with an evaluation, an appraisal, and a means of learning from this, then we've lost a great deal that we could have gained from this. And this, I feel, is a final element of a strategy for policy, determination of policy issues, and formulation. Now let's go back to the directions of the 1970s again. This is something that concerns us a great deal. Yesterday, I gave you some very crude figures, but figures that I felt are strategic in indicating the nature and direction of change. And these indicated, I think, quite clearly that the 1970s will be a period of continued and accelerated rate of shift in our basic economy from federal government defense support, which it has had in the past, to a natural resource economy with a strong international orientation. Just to review some of the figures, taking petroleum production, for example, I don't have a good current figure of this year's production, but it's probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 200,000 barrels daily. The pipeline capacity, which is our only concrete evidence of what the industry is thinking about in terms of production from the North Slope, will range from 500,000 barrels daily to 2 million barrels daily. And this is only part of the production they expect to get out. If it were all of it, they wouldn't be concerning themselves frantically with the Northwest Passage or possibly another line through Canada. And so we can anticipate a tremendous expansion in the value of our natural resources, products, and of course in the amount the state receives as revenues. Or moving down to a more modest scale, but still quite impressive, forest products. I mentioned one contract which the U.S. Plywood Champion has signed with the Japanese firm, which will double the present value of all exports from Alaska to foreign countries. And this will be on an annual basis. And there are many more developments of this sort, which you are all familiar with one way or another. And so we had this very massive shift of our basic economy to a new base, a different base. And this is very important to us when we talk about policy, because this will condition the environment, the economic environment, and the political environment in which we attempt to formulate policies for the development of Alaska. It will shift our concern from economic to social development, on the one hand, but on the other hand, it will also introduce forces which may make it difficult for us to clearly define and keep to the promotion of what we consider to be the objectives we all want to achieve. I cited the tax incentive example yesterday. I'm going to come back to this, but because I wasn't there and don't know all the details, I'm just going to let's take this as a hypothetical case of the necessity for being informed. The company coming into Alaska to establish a large industry, a large plant, first of all has to select its site. It was obvious that the site selection is determined by certain physical characteristics. Basically, if you're putting in a pulp mill, you have to have a site where fresh water is available, where the waste can be flushed out effectively, and so on, where there's log storage and all the rest of this. It was quite obvious to most people who were involved in the decision that the logical choice was the one that the mill made. But the mill, because it was coming into a new territory, also was concerned that the local community conditions be favorable, both of them in terms of tax payments, but also in terms of certain community amenities and so on, so that the labor force would be happy. And so as part of their strategy, a logical thing to do would be to keep people guessing as to where they were locating, and in the process have one community play off against another in arriving at concessions. In other words, this was a bargaining process that they were carrying out on their own terms. And then finally, because a law existed and a program existed for getting certain tax incentives, it was logical to see what would happen there by merely applying for these. Now, if the management of the company did not do these things, they might have been in danger of having a stockholder suit against them for having failed to look out for the best interests of that particular corporation. On the other hand, nobody was representing the public interest in this particular negotiation. If there had been somebody there, I think the decision would have been the same, given the physical requirements. But there might have been quite a different outcome as far as the concessions that were brought out. The community would still have to promise to do certain things. But the community would also have to make it clear that this would cost money and this required taxes. And perhaps a happier solution might have been arrived at. As I say, I only dwell on this because this is something that has happened and I think illustrates the point. If we were fully informed about the requirements of the industry coming in, the sort of behavior pattern it would be expected to follow given its ultimate responsibility to its stockholders, then we could somehow discern the strategy they would be following, and with a clear-cut understanding of what our interests, the Alaskan and public interests were in this situation, arrive at a compromise which would not be a giveaway. We're going to be called upon to do this sort of thing repeatedly now in the future, and the stakes are much, much higher than the example I gave. We will give away Alaska's public interest, not because the other side is particularly evil or wicked or out to do us in. I don't believe this one bit, but because they have a certain behavior pattern which they follow through, and they expect us to be aware of this. We also have to be informed. We will do what we will do either out of ignorance or out of a basis of knowledge and sound information. And that's why it's so important for us to build up the preconditions for this, dealing in this situation. When we get into the international situation, which I won't get into now, it gets even more complex. Because there we're dealing with people who look like American businessmen, but who really aren't. And I won't go into that any further. Now, there are other things that we should do when we look at the 1970s. We should understand the limitations of the Alaska development effect of this investment that is being contemplated. It is typical, both in Alaska and other areas where new investments are coming in, for the benefits from the new investment to fall below the expectations or the anticipations. And of course, this is obvious. We've been through this before, and I think we're perhaps better prepared than most areas because we have had some rather massive investments. The direct impact of the investment is initially outside the region. The TAPS pipeline, for example, the impact of that investment is initially in Japan, where the pipe is manufactured, and then in the transportation companies who transport the pipe to Alaska, and so on. Eventually, there is an impact within Alaska. But the impact is not measured in terms of the total investment, but a fraction of that investment. Now, there's another manner in which the impact of the investment may fall below the expectations. And this is, again, as a result of a deficiency of data or analytical tools. A lot of the subsequent effects of the development, which we might capture, are apt to escape us due to our ignorance in these areas. What we are concerned about when a big investment of this sort comes about is how to maximize the impact within Alaska. And this is not necessarily one of setting up a lot of restrictions, increasing the tax base, and so on, things that really, as Paul Oversacker or was it Dick mentions, don't indulge in soaking new industry too hard, because this has a way of having repercussions. But it's how to convert these initial investments into an enlargement of the state's total productive capacity, its ability to create jobs and income. In part, this involves changing ourselves. If we are part of the labor force, it requires retraining so that we can qualify for the new jobs. If we are in the supporting industries of banking, services, and trades, it requires that we accommodate ourselves to the new requirements being imposed upon us by this new investment. If we do not, a labor force will be imported from outside, and various supporting capital requirements, various services and supplies will be also supplied from outside Alaska. And so some of the benefits that we might realize from this investment will again go outside. This requires not only knowledge and analytical ability, but an ability to change and adjust ourselves. We should increase our ability to identify ways and means in which new economic activity linkages can be formed with the major basic economic developments. For example, the establishment of a large processing plant in an area. As far as the people who are setting this up is concerned, when they have established that plant, the supporting transportation system, the community, and so on to support it, that's as far as their responsibility goes. But in the process of doing this, they've done a number of other things. They've changed the transportation system. They've made it possibly capable of doing the job of transporting goods and people more economically than in the past. This opens up the possibility of what might have been considered marginal or completely uneconomic developments, making these possible to be developed locally by people who have necessary capital and managerial ability and so on to put these things together. The industry itself may create situations, for example, a pulp mill creates the opportunity of setting up smaller forest products utilizing industries. These may work right down to little operations such as the manufacture of shakes and shingles or something of this sort, which is not a very economic operation if you have to go out and do the logging and everything, but which might conceivably be economic if one of the byproducts of the supplying the big producer can be utilized in your small plant. We've got to identify and develop all these things we can along the line. Another thing is to develop certain inputs into the basic industry, possibly in the manufacture of pulp, for example. We may have certain mineral deposits close by that might be utilized in manufacturing certain of the chemical inputs required in that industry. We may not. It may not be economic if we do have. But we should not allow any of these possible opportunities to go unchecked. We should check everything out when a big development comes in to see to what extent we can maximize the impact of this development, this investment, upon the Alaska development scene. Now, let me do something else now. Let me translate some of the more obvious developments of the 1970s into something that we might understand more, and that's employment and population. Unfortunately, I didn't have enough copies of this Manpower Outlook of the 1970s to be distributed to all of you. Don has about 30 copies. Some of you may have seen it. There will be more available, and I only bring this up because this is a very crude, primitive example of the process I've been talking about. In the narrative supporting the tables, I lay out my sources, my methodology, and I also lay out some of the assumptions used for each of the major regions of Alaska in arriving at these employment figures. What we did, we started from the best information we could get on the expected major basic developments in Alaska during the 1970s. We translated these into approximations of output, volume of output, and then using various national averages and indices, attempted to translate this into employment. One of the things that will come out of this survey I've described earlier will be a refinement of this process and a means for continuously revising and updating these calculations so they can be made more exact and more timely. But if you have had a chance to look at the figures, you'll see several things. In the first place, there will be a parallel expansion in population and employment, but it will not be as of such a magnitude as that of the value of the product turned out. And this, of course, is because, as we all know from our earlier discussions, these industries that are coming to Alaska are capital-intensive industries. They do not use a great deal of labor in turning out their product. So there will be change in the direction of expansion. When we look at the regional breakdown, we find that although there will be change, regional differences will persist through the 1970s, in some cases be intensified. This means that Alaska is not going to become more homogeneous in its makeup, but that there will persist regional differences. And unless we handle this in a statesmanlike way, this could, of course, cause sectional rivalries. It need not, but it has in the past, and it could in the future. The second thing to be noticed is that South Central Alaska, and in particular Anchorage, will continue to be the main growth center of the state. And it will grow at a continuing high rate. But there will also be other modest but significant growth centers elsewhere. 2 years ago, Time Life had turned out a book on the frontier states, Alaska and Hawaii. And one chapter was devoted to what they called, I thought erroneously, the Battle of the Cities. But there was a speculation there that projecting the present trends, Alaska might eventually become a one-city state, with Anchorage having all the population, and the rest of the state exploitation merely being carried out by groups sent out to handle the physical thing of extracting the resources and transporting them to the main center. However, the writer went on to then spell out reasons why this projection wouldn't come about. There were a lot of obvious reasons, among them the obstinacy of human beings to want to do their own thing and to stay where they are. I happen to be one of those people, by the way. So Alaska will continue to offer Alaskans a choice of places to live, even though Anchorage will continue to be the center and will continue to grow at a very satisfactory rate in terms of the expectations of the local people here. And I think this is a very important thing in Alaska, is that we do have this opportunity to select a place to live, to select a way of making a living, and to develop our own lifestyles if we wish. We do not have to be assimilated into the dominant culture, to borrow a phrase from another group. Now, a final thing that comes out from the data in these tables, and I'm limiting myself only to the data in these tables, and these don't represent everything we should be considering. There are two indices here that I've included. One is the rate of participation of the population in the workforce, and the other is the total unemployment as a percentage of the total workforce. Now, I've indicated in my tables and for the regions an improvement in both these rates, that there will be increased participation of the population in the workforce, and that there will be a progressive decline in the unemployment rate. This varies regionally, of course. But when I did this, I made certain assumptions. One of these was that there would be a movement of native population from the present village areas into the urban centers where the employment opportunities were going to be concentrated or most dominant. If this did not occur, then given the present rate of natural increase of our native population, the rate of participation would fall tragically. In other words, the labor force in Alaska would, I mean, the population in Alaska would be underutilized in terms of being part of the productive employment force, and the rate of unemployment would continue to rise. And accompanying this, of course, would be all of the tragic things of human misery and so on. Now, in making this assumption, I did not assume that the villages would disappear. On the contrary, the evidence Art Hippler and others have compiled indicate the villages are very tough. Many of them will continue in spite of everything because something still exists there for making it, giving people a reason for staying there. There is an economy of a sort, but more importantly, this economy, although in our terms, in terms of the urban society, may be inadequate, there are other compensations. And so this will persist. But the point is that there will have to be, as the population increases in these areas, a movement of people. And it is my feeling that this is not only possible, but that will probably come about without too much pain, because people, being what they are, want to do different things. Children don't always want to do what their fathers did. And there will be a natural out-migration as we move into the 70s. Now, what policy implications do we get from this picture? One thing I think we get is that, given the persistence of regions and the persistence of population in other areas, there's going to be need to strengthen our intermediate levels of government. This is one area in which we are still trying to do things, we're still sort of falling behind the need. But as we go into the 1970s, because, as I say, there will be employment, there will be population in different parts of Alaska, the basic economies in these parts of Alaska will differ from one another, the conditions, social and physical, will differ, there's going to be need for a decentralization of various governmental functions to make them more responsive to the needs that emerge in the regions. In other words, we must get on with the business of developing our intermediate levels of government. A second thing that comes out very strongly is the policies relating to continuing and accelerating urbanization. Now, with minor exceptions, Alaska has always been an urban society. I have to, of course, make my own definition of this term. But I think we too often confuse urban with numbers of people. Urban also has something to do with the way people live. An urban society is a society in which people, their employment is specialized, their lives are specialized. They're pulled together in a certain way to share certain community functions. A rural society is one in which the society is generalized and independent, self-reliant in the sense of the individual doing many things and doing it for himself. With the exception of some of the Eskimo and northern interior Indian societies before the coming of the white man, certainly the coastal and southeast Indians were primitive urban peoples. Their society was based upon a division of labor and a rather intensive trade. There was specialization. They lived a fairly sedentary lives except when they were harvesting resources or trading. They had a complicated social structure, and so on. Alaska's developments started not with individual frontiersmen coming up with axe and gun, although there were some, but the main thrust of the new frontier was an urban industrial society. Commercial fishing and fish processing for its period was a highly industrialized activity, and it required and it developed settlements rather than scattered individual people out in the wilderness. And today, of course, we're moving in an acceleration of this trend. Alaska has always been a dominantly urban society, and it's becoming more so. This means that we've got to consider a lot of things that we wouldn't consider if we were a strictly traditionalist frontier society. And among these things are things such as amenities. We mentioned this in connection with my example of the highways. And I said that 10 years later, I would perhaps reverse my presentation because now the need for amenities of this sort are more important than some of the pioneering development needs I saw 10 years ago. Within the urban society, we've got to concern ourselves with environment, but this time it's a man-made environment. It's not protection of a physical, natural environment so much as it is the creation of a man-made environment in which it is possible for human beings to live decent lives. And of course, by environment, I mean not just simply the things we see, but everything that affects our lives living in an urban center. Health, safety, so on. We need, and all you have to do is look, I don't care what Alaska town, city, or village you're talking about. Left to ourselves, we have a way of despoiling our environment as we're making it. We litter the landscape around our cities with junkyards. Within our cities, we pay no attention to the impact of a particular structure upon the total townscape that we should be concerning ourselves with, and so on. Urbanization is going to be one of our key areas, and this requires everything from a reconsideration of fiscal taxation all the way up to the provision of amenities and the prevention of uglification, if I might use the expression. Now, the third thing is the matter of the native population again, and I won't dwell upon this because we've all gone through this till we know it backward and forward. But I mentioned the persistence of the village economies at the same time the necessity for the movement of increasing numbers of native peoples from the villages. On the one hand, policy in this part of Alaska, which we should call rural Alaska, I think, should be toward improvement of the village situation, not in terms of merely providing amenities, but if there is a potential for developing, improving an economy to do so, and then increasing mobility of people so that they can make a choice, a real choice in the situation. The conference I attended in France was concerned with the threat or disappearance of Eskimo societies internationally in the face of Arctic developments that were taking place in the Soviet Union, Alaska, Canada, and Greenland. The people who organized the conference were Frenchmen. Frenchmen still have a romantic attachment to the concept of the noble savage, and all of their presentations were directed toward preserving the traditional hunting society at all costs. The Greenlanders who were there were for preserving Greenlandic society, but not necessarily a hunting society. They, of course, a century or more ago, had moved most of them from that way of life. The Russians, as always in a conference of this sort, are very smug and pleased with themselves. We, as Alaskans, Canadians, and Danes, have a tendency to berate ourselves, tell what failures we are, and weep over this. The Russians sit back and smile and say, we have no problems by definition. But they made the statement that in Russia, we preserve the traditional hunting society. And so we questioned them further on this. And it turned out what they were talking about was something different. But I'm bringing up the example because there's something to it. There are people in looking, and I'm simplifying the whole process now, at trying to plan for extracting the most out of the landmass of Russia, looked at the northern tundra areas. The things that were produced there by the hunting society were meat and furs. So what the planners did was to examine the process of hunting and trapping and decide that the tundra could be made to yield a greater yield of meat, a better quality of furs by reorganization of the activities. In place of hunting, the hunters now are reindeer herdsmen. Their herds are managed scientifically, and they're moved around, the range is managed scientifically, and so on. In place of trapping, they now have fur farms, and they told us very proudly about their experiments in breeding animals to increase the quality of the fur, and so on. So really what they were doing was making it possible for traditional peoples to continue living in their native areas, on their own land, and so on. But, and this I think was the important thing, they were no longer traditional hunters or trappers. They were now cattlemen of the tundra and farmers of the tundra. Now, whether or not the people are happy doing this, we'll never know, because the Russians told us they were very happy. They go on singing their native songs and doing their native dances and so on. But there's something for us to learn here. Looked at in terms of the total Alaska situation, these sort of activities seem very marginal in terms of the input of labor measured against the output of product. They certainly are marginal. But in terms of making it possible for people to live in different parts of Alaska and live different ways of lives, I think that they have a great deal of value. And when we talk about the village situation, let's not just talk about telephones and electric lights, but let's start talking about what are the resources in these areas, how can these resources be made to produce an economy that will make it possible for people, if they wish, to continue living there, but to live lives in which they will have more of the things that make it possible to survive. Now, I think I said enough. I've gone beyond my time, and I probably confused you totally. But what I'm trying to say here is that we've got to re-examine what we have been doing here, re-examine our appraisal of the outlook, and now begin to select what are the key major focuses for policy if we are to build the type of future in Alaska we all wish. Thank you.